Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. I am Kim Colton, your host. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. This is my first show as host of CrimeWire since Denny Griffin stepped down to pursue new and exciting adventures, and he passed the torch to me. I am privileged to have a roster of consultants, and on future shows, you, the listener, will have the chance to hear from experts like Karen Stornstein, Dr. Scott Bond, Donna Pendergast, Holly Hughes, Peter Hyatt, Monica Case, and Cheryl McCullen, and several more, all bringing aboard their expertise and assistance to help bring cases to the forefront. Let me introduce my guest co-host for tonight, Donna Pendergast, homicide prosecutor from Michigan. Welcome, Donna. Thank you for Thank you for coming to my maiden voyage.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
So, how are you tonight?
I'm great. Ready to tackle the cases of the day.
Exactly. You must be a busy lady, too.
I'm always busy, but never too busy for CrimeWire.
Oh, that's great. You know, one of the biggest cases recently has been the Jodi Arias case. And I thought we could just kind of touch on this a bit because it did end in a mistrial. And I wanted to have you explain to our listeners what this means. What does a mistrial mean? And what does it mean when they say that they're just going to be retrying the penalty phase?
Well, you know, Kim, you know, there are a lot of things at this stage of the game that are uncertain, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. One thing is certain, and that is that the Jodi show continues. And that's really all it can be termed as the Jodi show, because I've never seen a trial quite like this debacle. But in answer to your question about a mistrial, a mistrial can occur a number of different ways. A mistrial is reached when the trial ends without a verdict. Now, in this case, there was a verdict, a first-degree murder. That conviction still stands, but they were still in a second phase of the trial, which is the penalty phase. And actually, the penalty phase had two separate stages. Number one, before you could ever progress to whether or not the death penalty would be handed down, the jury had to find that it was exceptionally cruel, which they did that.
Then they
had to go to the second stage, which, according to most sources, there was an 8-4 deadlock in favor of giving her the death penalty. But a mistrial is reached either when the trial ends without a verdict, or it can also be reached for a number of other reasons, errors in the trial, if there's juror misconduct, or if there's a hung jury, like this case. So in this case, what they are going to do is bring in a new jury, give them a thumbnail sketch of the underlying facts, and then ask them to just debate the death penalty issue, which the last jury spent 13 hours on before they deadlocked.
Yes, and now they won't have, the new jury won't have to go through days and days of Jodi Arias' testimony.
No, they're going to be given kind of a thumbnail sketch of the underlying case, and then be tasked with the task of looking at the death penalty phase as, you know, whether or not they feel like they can hand that down. Perhaps the biggest problem that they're going to have is getting a jury, because quite frankly, impaneling a death penalty jury is a difficult thing. People have very strong feelings about the death penalty. You know, it's going to be a hard task when you didn't hear all the underlying facts any jurors and panel, they're going to have a lot of questions, but only a jury can hand down a death penalty sentence. For example, if this second jury were to deadlock again, you know, the judge can hand down a sentence, but he can't hand down a death penalty sentence. If it went back to the jury because of to the judge because of a second deadlocked jury, he could hand down a natural life sentence, which means life in prison without the possibility of parole, or what's known as an indeterminate life sentence, which is a nonspecific term of years, you know, like 25 years to life or something. But the judge cannot sentence Jody Arias to death. Only a jury can do that under Arizona law.
Oh, okay. But it's different. It might be different in another state.
Yes. Yeah, that is correct.
And I do want to encourage our listeners to call in with any questions. The number is 646-478-0982. That is very, very interesting. That whole case was, was played quite brilliantly by her, in my opinion. I think she kind of held all the cards and...
You know, there's one thing. She's mentally unstable, but she's a master manipulator. There's no question about that. I think her manipulations, though, you know, right down to the changes in her appearance, jurors aren't stupid. And they try to do the right thing for the most part. And, you know, I think what was really interesting about this trial is the fact that it wasn't reined in more. You know, I've done over 100 murder trials, and I can't imagine a judge letting, you know, a defendant be on the stand 19 days and ask many questions over and over again, you know, duplicitous questions and redundancy, those types of things, you know, in any trial I've ever been on, you know, the judge is right in there and it's, let's move this along. But, you know, I had to laugh. I saw my friend Beth Karras from True TV one, being interviewed one night, and she's just like, enough! It's just enough, because enough of the sordid details, enough of the, you know, the just ongoing craziness of the trial. But that's the fault of the judge. Judges control the proceedings, and in this case, they weren't controlled very well.
Yes, I agree. There is definitely, it definitely went on and on, that's for sure. And it certainly was sorted, but I think having her on the stand that long was a smart move. It's hard for a jury, even though they sign a piece of paper saying, yes, I can sentence someone to death, I can do that, and then have them sit through days and days of testimony and having her so close to them, only feet, you know, very close and looking right at them. And even though it's hard, it becomes, I think, difficult for anybody. We have to put ourselves in their shoes, but for anybody to sentence somebody to death that you've practically gotten to know.
And, you know, that's
like
very
down your pet hamster.
Right. That's a very interesting point that you raise, because I always tell my juries that there's something psychological and very real about that whole idea of seeing somebody in court every day, and they become real to you. And I'm constantly telling my juries, you know, the victim here is not real to you. She's just a name, or he's just a name. He's a face on a piece of styrofoam. You see this person every day, you know, but, you know, the reason that my victim is not real to you is because of the actions of this person.
Right.
But, you know, when you've been in a courtroom with somebody for 3 months and seen that person every day, even if you despise them, even if you see through their manipulations, to still make that decision that I'm going to kill that human being, or I am going to, you know, send a verdict that will result in the death of that human being, you might think going into it you can do it, but it's not easy.
Right. It's not. I'm sure. Well, I don't want to go into too much detail about Jodi Arias. Maybe we'll touch back on it later. It's a very interesting case, but I think people need a little, I think folks need a little bit of a break.
Well, they have one. Jury selection is set for July 18th, so they've got about 6 weeks to, you know, cleanse their palate, so to speak, before they have to hear all these sort of details again.
Yep. And, you know, they were able to find a jury for Casey Anthony, so I'm sure they'll be able to find a jury for Jodi Arias. It's amazing. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, I've had defense attorneys on some of my higher profile cases ask for a change of venue because there can't possibly be people out there who don't know about this case or that case. But you're absolutely right. And the Casey Anthony case proved it. And that is that there's a lot of people who don't watch the news, who don't want to watch that kind of stuff, who don't listen to the radio. And, you know, just to, you know, turn it off or never listen to the crime stories. So I've never had a hard time picking a jury, no matter how high profile the case is. So, you know, the big issue is going to be not the notoriety of the case, but, you know, the ability of the various potential jurors to render a death penalty decision if it's merited.
Right, right. And it is so amazing to me, really, how similar Jodi and Casey are in their pathological sociopath
narcissism.
Ways. Narcissism.
Yeah.
Total
yeah.
narcissism. Borderline personality disorders. Bingo.
Not even borderline. I mean, I think in
well,
both circumstances, you had narcissists who... you know, are adept at manipulating people and you know, play the jury in both circumstances. You know, to a certain extent of success, well, certainly in the Casey Anthony case, you know, total success, but in this case, at least on the death penalty phase, you know, you've got Chameleon Jodi changing from, you know, well, I want the death penalty. And then, you know, 2 days later, she's testifying, please spare me. I'll teach Spanish to children and donate my hair. For God's sake.
I know. Oh, that lock. I donated hair to Locks of Love. So you need to spare my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I stabbed a man 29 times and split his throat and shot him, but I donated my hair.
Give me a break.
Oh, my God.
Oh, it's wild, I'll tell you. It is just wild. Well, okay. Another case I know we want to discuss is that of Susan Powell. Susan Powell, let me just remind our audience, her story first gained attention when she vanished from her suburban Salt Lake City home in the middle of the night in December 2009. The documents released this past May 20th show that police focused on her husband, doubting his alibi from the outset. No kidding. Josh Powell said his wife went missing shortly after he left to go camping in the high desert with their sons, who were 2 and 4 years old at the time, despite a snowstorm that blanketed the area. That's just, I think we all remember this case. The police investigation led to searches of abandoned mines in Utah, neighboring Nevada. And authorities kept their attention on Josh Powell even as he moved from West Valley City, Utah to Washington, where he ultimately attacked his boys with a hatchet last year after saying he had a big surprise for them. He then set his home on fire, causing an explosion that killed them all as a social worker watched in horror. So that's the long and short, but the recently released documents, Donna, I think they had enough evidence to put him away or to something from the get go. They released, since they've, of course, you know, the case is closed, they were released a written last will and testament and video made by Susan, that indicated she was in imminent danger, and she knew it. And she wrote, if something happens to me, it may not be an accident. And, wow, this just, this is unbelievable. Her, I guess her parents had custody of the children, but he had visitation, supervised visitation. And when the social worker tried to come in, the kids ran into the house. And when she tried to come in, he refused to let her enter and lock the door. But everything in this case, his strange father, I mean, there's so much. I don't know how. I just feel that there was enough within weeks of this, of her going missing, to prevent Josh Powell from leaving the state of Utah and making an arrest. I don't know what they were waiting for. What do you think?
Well, you know, Kim, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, I think this really, for those in, of our listeners in the audience who are familiar with Susan Murphy, you know, this just shows the importance of, you know, her big campaign, which was the, you know, evidentiary affidavit for women who feel that they're in trouble or feel that, you know, that their life may be threatened, to document it, because that's exactly what Susan Powell was attempting to do.
Yes.
She was documenting what was going on in her life. And, you know, she's screaming out, really, in these videotapes saying, if something happens to me, even if it looks like an accident, you know, don't be convinced that it is an accident, because,
right,
you know, she was living in a very, clearly, in a very volatile situation. And, yeah, the whole circumstance,
oh, yeah,
from the get-go, I mean, come on, he takes his two-year-old, Josh Powell takes his two-year-old and four-year-old camping, according to his own words, at 12:30 at night, and
yeah,
he, you know, her kids don't, I mean, his kids don't show up for daycare, so his own parents, Josh Powell's own parents, alert the police thinking something's wrong at the household because the children haven't shown up for daycare. The police break into the house because they think maybe the family is suffering from carbon monoxide, and nobody's
right
there. And then Josh shows up back home at 5:30. Oh, well, I left Susan sleeping at midnight last night, took the boys up into the mountains camping at midnight in the middle of a
right
snowstorm. So, you know, obviously he suspects from the very start, but then you've got traces of her blood in the house. You know, her cell phone left behind, her purse left behind, her car left behind, and a $1.5 million life insurance policy on her, and a handwritten letter describing not only her turbulent marriage, but, you know, expressing her fear for her life. So, clearly, not only do you have a person of interest, you have some pretty strong circumstantial evidence that, you know, something has happened to her. And then you have the four-year-old. That's a little trickier because it would be difficult to qualify him, which means prove to a court of law that he's capable of testifying. But he makes comments to two different people that that Susan Powell went on the camping trip with them and that she was in the trunk.
Yep.
So
yep,
I certainly would take that to a jury.
Oh,
like,
I
know. But for him, you know, who else would have done something like this? You know, and then you have just the bizarre relationship that was going on. Josh Powell's father, who, you know, to put it blankly and candidly, by everybody's accounts, was a creep, was obsessed with Susan, was spying on her, was videotaping her without her knowledge. I mean, just some very bizarre dynamics going on. And
extremely bizarre. And this weird song that he did. Oh, my gosh. In fact, I'm going to try to get that for our listeners right now. Find the link to that because you've got to hear this. It, let's see, the lyrics, and she was just absolutely freaked out by this. that he, you know, and then after she's dead, he says, he claims that she came on to him and they had this sexual relationship. That is just so victimizing the victim all over again.
Well, in terms of victimizing, re-victimizing the victim, you know, don't forget that Stephen Powell not only claimed that Susan Powell was mentally ill, but that she had left, that she had abandoned her family in the middle of the night, just coincidentally when they were away on a camping trip in a snowstorm, but that she had abandoned the family and run off with another man.
Oh.
So, you know, talk about re-victimizing the victim, just, you know, beyond the pale.
Right. Oh, it's beyond the pale. It's beyond the pale. And let's just say that Stephen Powell, of course, is in jail. When police went to his home and seized his computer, they found, what was it, pictures, I think, of young girls that were unaware that he was filming them or taking pictures of them. And
well, they found child pornography, not just pictures of children.
Oh.
They found child pornography.
Oh, my gosh.
In addition to, you know, videotapes that clearly had been, you know, secretly taken of numerous women and young girls. But, you know, in addition to that, there was actual child pornography on the computer. And ultimately, he was arrested on charges of both voyeurism and child pornography.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, oh, he's just the creepiest guy. And another thing is that she had said in her diary, I believe it was, that I lost my train of thought. I'm sorry.
she did indicate in her diary that he was a creep and that she was afraid of him. I'm not sure which point you were going to make, but clearly in her diary, but they exploited her diary out of context and, you know, would post excerpts from it to Stephen Powell to substantiate, you know, their assertions that Susan was mentally unstable.
Right.
But,
Yeah, and actually it was just the other way around. Josh, when they first got married, Susan and Josh, she was a 20-year-old newlywed, and she was just absolutely in love. And everything was great with them. I mean, they went to church regularly. If they didn't go to church, if they missed it for some reason, they would take long walks together. Everything seemed fine. She did say that she thought he was kind of acted like a big kid sometimes, but everything was fine. And then just everything changed. And she noted that he started acting more and more like his father. It was just, I don't know if I can, let's see here where I have that information, but she just notes that he became very controlling. He monitored her conversations with her sister, all kinds of things. And she said that her father-in-law was very meddlesome and negative, and he had that influence on her husband. And Josh started becoming like him. And Josh also started distancing himself from the church, as his father had done years earlier.
Thing about this is, by all accounts, things had gotten so bad at the end. I mean, not only was she making, pleas, you know, or documenting just, you know, issues just in case something happened to her, but Josh had become, according to all sources, so controlling that he was not even letting her buy groceries. She was, you know, quite a homemaker. She canned things from the garden, things of that nature. But they said that she was trying to feed the boys on what she could pull out of the garden. And, the boys were starting to suffer health effects because they weren't getting enough food because Josh wouldn't even let her buy groceries.
Right.
I mean, money
right.
had always been an issue in the marriage. That
right.
that was one issue that, you know, had been consistently popping up in the marriage or had popped up consistently. But, you know, just the tragedy of, you know, the circumstances under which she was living in fear and doing without and living under the thumb of this controlling man and trying to document it and say, you know, knowing something could well happen to her, you know, that's what Susan Murphy fought for, you know, her whole life is to,
oh, I know.
You know, empower people like Susan Powell to document what's going on and, you
right.
know, as you know with Susan, the extra
right.
step to get him away from the situation. But
And she wrote about this case. She wrote about this and talked about it extensively.
I know
and,
she did.
Yeah, and, you know, she really, really was right in there helping Susan Powell. But, you know, Susan, we got two Susans here, Susan Murphy Milano, thought
right.
that she had gone ahead and done what she needed to do. You know, by all indications, Susan Powell had done everything she could have, but I guess she didn't. I guess she didn't give a copy to her lawyer. She didn't give a copy to a close friend. You know.
Yeah, she took the first step. She was documenting.
Yes, she did.
She wanted people
oh, yeah.
to know. In case
yep.
something happened, but can you imagine living under such an apprehension, such apprehension in your day-to-day life that you are documenting? It happens every day, but you are documenting in case you end up dead. I mean, can you imagine living under those circumstances?
No.
Just horrible. And, you know, having two small children to try and take care of the feed when... You know, you're worried about your own life from day to day. It's just a terrible circumstance. And,
right.
you know, as it all imploded in the end, as it turns out, you know, she had good reason not only to be fearful for her own life, but the life of her children who were ultimately killed at the hands of that lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just a terrible circumstance, and the only person who really knows what happened and who I'd suggest to you knows a heck of a lot more than he's told authorities is Stephen Powell.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, clearly, just based on the circumstances, you know, him taking the Fifth Amendment to authorities and other things, you know, Could there ever be a trial down the line for complicity in Susan Powell's death? You know, maybe, but, you know, Stephen Powell's certainly never going to talk. But he certainly knows what happened, and whether or not he helped plan her disappearance, I wouldn't be the least bit surprised because, you know, he was the one who had the big influence on his son. But,
oh,
you know, the final chapter, you know, I mean, to me, I've been a prosecutor for 26 years, and, you know, just that final scene even stunned me where, you know, because of Stephen Powell's child pornography, you know, custody of the children was taken away from Josh Powell because Josh Powell continued to live with Stephen Powell. And,
right.
you know, he proclaimed he had a second residence. He was still only receiving supervised custody. And, you know, that horrific day to, you know, the children arrive at the house for supervised custody. And, you know, he gets
yeah.
the kids in the house, locks out the social worker, and, you know, hacks the two children in the neck with a hatchet or the head. I'm not sure. I don't recall. But, and then, you know, has gas all over the house, where he blows up the house with all three of them in it. I mean, that is a, you know, catastrophic event that never should have occurred.
Right.
You know, with
never.
The volatility of Josh Powell, those kids should not have been allowed to wander into that situation. And what a horrible tragedy. I mean, like I said, even the hardened person like myself just stunned by that tragic mm-hmm. and catastrophic turn of events.
Yeah. And one of our guests in the chat room pointed out that the children died for two reasons. One was to deny custody to her parents, and two, they knew too much and were beginning to talk. True, true.
True, true. Absolutely.
And she wonders how long it'll be till Stephen Powell, once he gets out of the slammer, starts, as I don't think he got out yet.
No, he hasn't. He was convicted last May, and no, he's still in.
She just, our guest says, I wonder how long it will be before he starts with the child porn and voyeurism thing again. For sure.
Yeah, because those people don't change. And, you know, the missing persons case on Susan Powell, ironically, was closed this month. You know, her father, Susan Powell's father, Chuck Cox, he's launched his own search this week. But, you know,
good
the police
him.
Have run out of tips.
Yeah, good for him. I'm glad he did.
This week
another,
he announced... Oh,
I was just going to say, another guest in the chat room said the number one reason the children died is because no one in the system was brave enough to keep them away from their father. We got some smart cookies in that chat room, let me tell you. But yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead with what you were saying.
Oh, I was just going to say that, you know, Chuck Cox announced on the Susan Cox Powell Foundation website Tuesday that he was starting on a search on a 400-mile stretch of Interstate 84 that went from Oregon to northern Utah. So what information he has that has put him on that 400-mile stretch, I don't know. But, you know, the authorities have run out of steam and run out of tips. So, you know, that's a father
right.
who's heck-bent on finding answers and, you know, Godspeed to him.
Oh, for sure, for sure. And, of course, I don't know if our listeners are aware that Josh's brother, I think his name is Michael, committed suicide. And the police really believed also that he was very much involved and that he helped get rid of her body. And they also think that Stephen Powell was maybe the mastermind behind the whole thing, his father. Very weird.
And we can all hope, you know, I mean, Josh Powell's dead at his own hands, but... we can all help. We can all hope that, you know, if there was some complicity on the part of Stephen Powell, that, you know, there still may be a prosecution down the line because, you know, I've seen cases 30 years old and one almost 40 years old that I've taken to trial and got convictions on. So arrogant psychopaths like Stephen Powell, they have a hard time keeping their mouth shut.
They do. They do. Give them enough rope, they'll hang themselves.
Over and over.
Yeah, yeah. They'll eventually hang themselves with all that rope.
So
that's what they do.
You know, I just pray that does happen down the line.
Me too.
Because, you know, the police have left no stone unturned. It hasn't been for lack of trying, but, you know, at this point they've just, you know, run out of chips as to where her body might be and as to how to link, you know, Stephen
mm-hmm.
Powell to the murder, but, you know, it's
mm-hmm.
not for lack of trying, that's for sure.
Well, the only thing that bothers me is that they didn't proceed with some sort of grand jury from before. So I just don't quite understand that. But otherwise, I guess they did, you know, do their job. Well, you see how I feel about that. there is another case we kind of wanted to touch on, and this one is an interesting one. It's about a priest. His name is John Fett. This is out of Phoenix, Arizona. He was possibly involved, the police feel he was involved, in a murder, but the murder took place back in 1960, and they the victim's name, I guess I should start from the beginning here. The victim's name was Irene Garza. She was found, she was last seen going to church to confession. She was a devout Catholic. And she, the priest who received her confession was Father John Veit. Garza was not seen by her friends or family after leaving for the church. It was a major story in Texas when it happened. People were worried and scared. Then it got worse. Garza's body was found in a canal. Her death certificate stated she was raped, beaten on the head, and suffocated. The main suspect in her death back then was the same person police say is the main suspect today, and that is Father Veit. When Garza's body was recovered, a 1950s vintage Kodak slide viewer was found near her body. Receipts showed the slide viewer was bought by Veit. The priest agreed to take lie detector tests, and he failed them. Interest in Veit intensified when police discovered that a few weeks before the slaying, Veit had been accused of attacking a woman in a church in a nearby city. The 20-year-old victim said she was leaning on the communion rail in the empty church when she was assaulted by him. He was arrested and charged, but a mistrial was declared in that case. Veit did not go through a second trial. He pleaded no contest and was fined $500 and was given no prison time. While waiting for resolution in the Garza case, Veit was sent to a monastery in Missouri, where he got to know a monk named Dale Techney. After 40 years of silence on the Garza case, Techney, no longer a monk, made a startling statement in 2002. Now, I bet everybody wants to know what that statement was. He said, "I was part of the cover-up for all these years." Now, let's talk a little bit first before we get into the church politics. Let's talk a little bit first about this man now is 74 years old. He is retired, and he lives in Phoenix. I don't know what kind of forensics they had back then or how they would have gone about, you know, in 1960, how they would have gone about except finding the Kodak equipment, how they would, you know, they didn't have DNA. I mean, what else could they do? It certainly, I don't think was an open and shut case because they found a receipt and the guy... Or is it because he didn't pass any of those polygraph tests either? I don't know. Is it an open and shut case back then? I mean,
Kim, let me make a couple of observations here.
Okay.
First and foremost, just talking about cold cases in general, conventional wisdom is that with a homicide case, if it's not solved in the first 48 hours, it's not going to be solved. Time is of the essence in a homicide case, and the more time that goes on, the less likely, or conventional wisdom has always been that the less likely it is that a case will be solved. But what we've been finding in the last decade or so with the advent of cold case squads and people who are looking specifically at cold cases, what we've found over and over again is that although that conventional wisdom does hold true, there are things that passage of time, there are ways that it can benefit a case.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean people come forward for various reasons. They find God, dynamics and relationships change, people can't keep their mouths shut. But you know,
right.
Passage of time can benefit a case. Which
mm-hmm.
is what happened in this case. I mean, two separate church officials have come forward now, years later, for motivations which aren't really clear, maybe conscience, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that when this crime happened in 1960, you know, there were a whole different set of societal dynamics out there. The church was sacrosanct. You know, nobody questioned the church like they do today after the patterns of sexual abuse that we've seen, things that have become everyday stories in the news to us, you know, these days, were unheard of back in 1960. So, you know, the dynamics in place at the time of church authorities protecting their own, no matter how deviant or how psychopathic, you know, were much stronger than they are today, where you know, people understand that there are bad priests out there. And
right.
In this circumstance, you know, I'm not a big believer in coincidence myself. And when you have an individual who is convicted of an attack on a woman 3 weeks before the murder of Irene Garza, also a young woman who's attacked, she identifies, you know, this priest. And I'm not sure if his name is pronounced Fett or Fight, but, you know, you have an attack on a woman, and then 3 weeks later, Irene Garza is off to confession, and the last person who saw her is Fight, by everybody's accounts. And then, you know, in the canal where her body's found is the slideshow, what do you call it, slide projector, which, you know, a receipt, you know, ties back to him. That's a pretty darn big coincidence.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
More recently, you have not only, you know, a monk from a monastery he was in after he was, like, hustled away after the murder of Garza, but you have a priest, another priest, Father O'Brien, who has come forward and says he assisted church authorities in a cover-up for years and years and years. Well, you know, to now it's, you know, some 53 years of cover-up.
Right.
But, you know, back then, do I think he had a case? We have something in the prosecution world called similar ex testimony, which means if you can show a pattern of behavior of sorts, you know, a common scheme or plan and system of doing an act, you can admit that as evidence. And in this case, you have a, you know, a priest who attacks a girl 3 weeks before. Is that enough to take it forward, coupled with that receipt? I would have. You know, I've won cases on less than that.
Yes, exactly. And one of our guests, Hobnob, she brought up a good point here. I wonder about this. Also, the sanctity of the confessional hinders cases because the priest cannot inform law enforcement. So what if it was, I mean, obviously, you know, with this Father Joseph O'Brien and the other gentleman, you know, it not necessarily it was he confessed to them. Maybe he did as a confessional type of thing, and they were not, they couldn't go to law enforcement, nor would the church want them to, or probably told them not to. But it just makes me wonder.
And you know what's interesting is in this case, you know, after two brutal attacks, the first woman got away from him.
Yeah.
3 weeks later, you know, clearly this is a sick individual. You know, he attacks again, but, you know, after he's, for lack of a better term, shipped away for rehabilitation, he went to a series of monasteries in Texas and Iowa and Missouri. But then he left the priesthood 10 years later to marry a woman and have three children with her. So, it became allegedly this model citizen, but, you know, by all appearances, he's a lead organizer of, you know, the Phoenix chapter of St. Vincent de Paul and all of these things going on, but people like him don't change. I just wonder if there were ever any other unsolved murders.
Where he lived.
You know, exactly.
Where he was. That should be looked into.
You don't just become a model citizen and get married and have three kids when you've attacked two women brutally 3 weeks apart. And, you know, there's no question it's him.
Oh, for sure.
So
that first monk that came forward, Techni, he said, I asked him one time, why are you here and not in prison? And Fight said, I was protected by the church authorities. I believe I was protected by the legal authorities. I don't know what that means. He said after about 6 months of treatment, church authorities believed it was safe for Fight to leave the monastery in Missouri. That was the last time Techni saw him. Techni has cooperated with police since disclosing information. And then in 2002, a different priest, Father Joseph O'Brien, who used to be close friends with Fight, broke his silence, telling police he believed Fight killed Garza. And then police reopened the murder case after Techni and O'Brien, or Techni, I'm not sure, and O'Brien told their stories. The district attorney, Rene Guerra, was initially hesitant to bring the case before a grand jury, but after a public outcry, he called a grand jury in 2003. Now, this is where it also gets interesting. His presentation of the case proved controversial. Guerra decided not to ask Techni or O'Brien to testify. Instead, he played tapes of interviews they did with police. He also did not request that Fight testify. The district attorney said he has not been interested in talking to Fight. And this is his reasoning. He said, if I make him a target, he's got the right to tell me to go to hell. In 2004, the grand jury decided not to indict Fight. Just over a year later, O'Brien died. Garza's family is angry at what they regard as a half-hearted prosecution effort. Garza's first cousin, Linda, believes the local Catholic Church has been holding up Fight's prosecution all these years. She says, I still believe fundamentally it's because it's a church issue. The district attorney said the church has nothing to do with how he has handled the case. So I don't know. What do you think, Donna? I mean, could the church, the Catholic Church in Michigan force you to not go after somebody?
No, not today. Not today. No. But once again, we're dealing with a case that happened in 1960, and the reticency of people, that they were just reticent and didn't come forward, that hampers current efforts by the district attorney. But, I want to point something out, too. In terms of going forward, one critical fact that we both forgot to mention was before the attack, which occurred in the church once again 3 weeks before Irene Garza's murder, that very same day of the first attack, there was a woman who went to confession and gave a confession to Fight. And we were talking about the issue of confession. But after the confession, he told her, I need to talk to you after confession, so wait for me. And this first potential victim was so disturbed by not only the words, but the manner in which they were delivered, that she ran home. You have a lot of different little pieces here. You have that coupled with the attack that same day, which he confessed to ultimately, pled guilty to and was fined. And then you have the murder with all the circumstances, tying him to it, the slideshow, the slide viewer. I can't think of what the name of it is. But the point is, as a prosecutor, as a district attorney, a prosecutor, whatever you want to call it, they use different names in different jurisdictions, but you have to weave different pieces of evidence together and create an understandable tapestry, so to speak, whether or not you're in front of a grand jury or whether or not you're in front of a jury of citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And, the manner in which you present your evidence determines whether or not you get an indictment out of a grand jury or whether or not you get a verdict out of a citizen's jury. So, presenting evidence, and I'm sure there's details that I don't know about, but presenting it at arm's length rather than putting an actual witness on the stand, putting on a tape of that witness, that certainly dilutes the effect of,
yeah,
you know, a witness who's, you know, telling you that the priest confessed to him.
Right.
Yeah. So that's something I just really don't understand.
Right.
And it was also very interesting that in the first attack that Fike committed, she bit him so hard that she left teeth marks on his finger. And, which were observed by a number of witnesses. So you had pretty conclusive testimony that tied him to that attack. And I'm sure that's what ultimately resulted in his confession. You put that in as a similar act and, you know, coupled with the circumstances surrounding Garza's murder. And, you know, I certainly had the evidence been put in the right way. I'm surprised they didn't get a grand jury indictment out of that. I really am.
Now, can they do that again, or you just get one shot at a grand jury indictment?
You know what? That's a very interesting question. And the reason I say that is because there is a case that I'm not at liberty to disclose that the question fairly recently has been asked of me. And I've done research on whether or not there is any precedent for petitioning a judge for a second grand jury, and I couldn't find any case law substantiating that. What I will say, just based on an educated guess, is there would have to be something really substantial, because a grand jury is an extremely expensive proceeding. You have the salaries of the judge, of all participants, of the grand jurors, the court reporter, it's an extraordinary proceeding, at least in Michigan, a grand jury is. Some states do that as their normal, process towards trial. Mm-hmm. But, you know, barring there being an extraordinary development or some substantial new evidence, I think a judge would be pretty loath to grant a second grand jury.
Oh, boy. How do you feel about the prosecutor, the district attorney, not putting Fite on the stand and saying, you know, if I do that, if I make him a target, I'll lose him? How do you feel about that?
You know, that is difficult for me to comment on, because I need to know all the dynamics of her thinking. And I haven't seen anywhere where she has expressed what she meant by, you know, she'd lose him if she made him a target. In Michigan we have a thing, the way our law works, we have a process called investigative subpoenas, and we normally do not put targets. The statute doesn't say you can't, but prosecutors don't put targets under an investigative subpoena, which is basically like a deposition under oath. So there may be something like that operating in that state that I'm not aware of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, because that was just a comment I didn't understand, and none of my research revealed an answer to that to me.
We have another good question from Hobbs. Do you think her family could file a wrongful death suit? I didn't think of that.
A wrongful death suit against who?
Fite. Garza's family.
Or the church, yeah. No, my guess is at this point in time, the statute of limitations has run on that.
Oh.
You know, there are constraints on filing cases in a court of law, and after certain periods of time go by, lawsuits are barred. They're barred by, you know, by what we call the statute of limitations, which means a bar on filing cases. Now, there are certain cases, certain crimes, that there is no statute of limitations. Like murder, you can bring a murder case 40 years later, should the evidence develop at that time frame. But to bring a civil wrongful death lawsuit, they'd be barred by a statute of limitations.
Okay. That makes sense. Well, we've got 5 minutes left, Donna, and there was one other case. I don't know if we want to really get into this. It's the person's name is Nicole Lynn Mansfield. And in a nutshell, she's the daughter of an American woman, and she was killed in a firefight in Syria. She converted to Muslim. She's from Flint, Michigan. 33 years old. She married briefly where was he from, Donna?
You know, I'm not sure. I know he was a Muslim, but I'm not sure what his country of origin was.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. It was somewhere in the Middle East. They divorced very quickly, so that kind of makes me... He was an Arab man. She married him in 2008. That's all it says about that. But they divorced soon after. Kind of makes me wonder about green cards, but whatever. But they feel that she was murdered, although Syria has been embroiled in a bloody civil war, and they said, nope, she got right into the middle of it and was fighting. So I don't know. That might be something we want to do for another day.
Yeah, the only comment I'll make on that case, Kim, is, you mm-hmm. know, the fact that there appears to be a lot of mystery and secrecy, you know, surrounding this case. You know, people mm-hmm. in the news media are asking a lot of questions. Who is Nicole Mansfield? Why did she secretly travel overseas before her death? And mm-hmm. I guess the only observation that you know, I'll make at this point, what really comes to mind to me is just how totally her personality seemed to change after mm-hmm. she got under the thumb of her husband. And where were we seen that before, you know, shades
right.
of, you know, the Boston bombing.
You've got
a woman who seemingly leading a normal life and gets involved with, you know, a person and converts, and the next thing you know, they're, you know, you just don't know. There's a lot of secrecy surrounding that person. So,
right.
you know, it's,
right.
just, it's just an unusual case, one to keep your eye on for the future.
Exactly. Well, I guess it's time to wrap it up and say goodnight. Thank you to all our great chatters in the chat room. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Donna, thank you so much. We should really need to do this again. You know, the Whitey Bulger case is coming up. That's set for trial. They're going to be picking the jury. That's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah, it sure is.
God bless him. Boy, he stayed on the run for a long time, didn't he? You got to give him a few kudos for that. At least he did, you know, he didn't donate any hair to Locks of Love, though. So I think, you know, he's
I never
he's
give
toast.
Kudos to a defendant for staying
he's
on
toast.
The run.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But thank you so much, Donna. It was such a pleasure to have you on my first show. Thank you.
Always willing, Kim.
Okay. And also, thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. Until next time, God bless and stay safe, and thank you again. Bye-bye, Donna.
Bye, Kim.
Thank you.